Moncrief on News Talk.
Joanna Fortune's with us once again. Afternoon,
afternoon,
Joanna.
Sean.
Right, first question. We have recently started transitioning my nine-month-old to a childminder ahead of my return to work in May. At 7 months, he became very wary of people unfamiliar to him and is very attached to his dad and I. He likes looking at people and babbles at them with when he's with us, but gets very upset when someone else holds him. We've started with 1 hour a day at the childminder, but even at that, he roars crying from the minute we've arrived to when we return. There's been no improvement after 8 visits. And I'm so worried that while we're aiming for a graded approach, what is actually happening is a cry-it-out approach of sorts. We won't even look, he won't even look at other children. And the childminder has said that she can't hold him continuously, understandably, and that some tough love will be needed. It feels like he just isn't ready, and I'm worried about the implications of his prolonged crying and distress. But yet, I have to go back to work. He seems to be getting even more clingy at home, and I think this is because he is so overwhelmed there. Any advice would be really welcome. I'm tempted to just press pause and have my husband or I take time from work to seek support from family where we can. But would it get any better in a few months?
I mean, look, this whole, I'm tempted to press pause when someone has already said, I have to go back to work, just shows how difficult this is. You know, with your baby becoming very wary of people at 7 months, that's so developmental. You know, they start making strange or having that, basically that capacity to notice your mom and dad and those other people are not. You know, they know that by kind of 4 to 6 months. Yeah. So it's really typical for them to develop those kind of is often described as making strange, but really it's about recognition of difference, you know. But it's also, you know, the research shows us, Sean, that when a baby sees somebody regularly, but not necessarily daily, so maybe a family member they see once or twice a week, grandparent or something like that, by around 6 to 9 months, they can show clear recognition and familiarity with their face, their voice, they come in, they know, oh, I know who you are. It takes time at this age, but also put it in the context of something we, you and I have spoken about here before, people permanence. You know, this little baby is still developing permanence, you know, that people are forever. It's very difficult when your person, your parent, your whoever it might be, leaves. Because you're like, well, where did they go? They've disappeared. They've ceased to exist. I don't like this feeling. Very smart little baby showing their displeasure for this by crying, you know, expressing it. And babies will express that displeasure with an expectation that somebody is going to make it better. So again, the childminder picking up the baby and holding him, which is fine when it's an hour a day. Maybe it's fine when it's an hour a day easing in. But your childminder is quite right. They will not be able to do that because they have to meet the needs of all the children in their care.
Yeah.
So from your baby's point of view, you and your partner, you are his secure base. You're his safe haven. OK, he is not going to bounce delightedly away from you in the door to what is still a strange new environment. Babies can and will form attachment, Sean, with adults who consistently care for them. So they will have preference within their attachment relationships, and that will be for their key attachment figures, parents, in other words. But they will form healthy attachments with other key caregivers in their life. And childminders would be central to that. Okay.
Sure.
So this isn't about, oh, you couldn't possibly leave him. But you do need time to build the relationship up. There's a part of me thinking that we talk about easing babies into childcare, but it's not just about getting, you know, the baby getting used to the minder. It's also the opportunity for the minder to get to know the baby and to get to know, who is this baby? How is this baby? What does this baby need from me? And am I in a position to provide what this baby needs? You know, it isn't as simple as one size fits all. If only, any parent who's done this transition would be, if only it was as easy as that. It's not. Couple of things to consider. And also, by the way, if you're listening, to utterly dismiss if you're like, we've done that and that's not an option. But I'm going to put it out there that for some children, a group care, even a small group care environment like this, where it's a childminder with a small number of kids, can be difficult. If this is a baby who's used to being at home with two adults and no other children, coming into a room where there's lots of other children who are noisy and busy and moving and dropping and picking up and falling and crying, that is a whole lot of sensory stimulation all at once. So a one-to-one at-home care, if that's an option, somebody coming into your home, minding him in his own familiar environment, that might be something that's an easier, not easy, but easier yeah. transition.
And more expensive probably as well.
No question. And also much harder to source.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
so being really realistic about that too. And also, you know, you're talking about, do you take time off and hit pause and slow this down? I wonder, is there, and I'm wondering, and I'm going to correct myself, but I'm still going to wonder out loud, if, you know, this hour where they're leaving him with the minder, could you stay for the hour
yeah,
so
yeah.
that you're holding him, because the minder can't, and you could almost be there as if you're visiting or having the cup of tea, but you're holding the baby and you're pointing things out and you're coming down to the floor with your baby and talking to the other kids, and you're helping to ease with you the secure base there with him. Now, the reason I'm going to correct myself is your child minder may be saying to you, you're not guard declared, I can't have you here with okay. the other children.
Fair
so
enough.
I do
yeah.
want to say that's not an assumption, but it might be something to explore and just talk about, because then you could build up to leaving, because you could start by leaving in the sitting room and going to the bathroom. You could go to the kitchen for 10 minutes. You could leave for 15 minutes. You could, you know, and gradually build up. I don't know how much more time they have left for this transition either. So it's just, you know, this is a process.
Mm.
And 8 visits, you think, God, why hasn't he settled in? It's only 8 visits, 8 single hours. That's all it is. It's still early days. It could
yeah.
take some children. Now, some children, Sean, bounce in. Anyone listening, if your child didn't blink when you left them, it doesn't
yeah.
mean anything
yeah.
that they don't love you. It's some children transition in easier than others. And this little guy is just having some trouble with it.
Yeah. God, doesn't make it easy though, really, does it?
No, it's not easy.
No.
And it's never easy anyway, because it's such a transition, not just for the baby, but for parent as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
And going back to work and the workplace, make sure you notify your employer that you are negotiating this very difficult transition and your little guy is struggling, and you might need some flexibility in your transition back into work as well, that it's not just about baby.
Yeah. I have a 5-year-old girl who's full of fun and mischief and the apple of her eye. After many failed pregnancies, we decided to go with a donor egg from Spain. It's an anonymous donation. Everything went well with the process. My question is whether to tell my daughter, in an age-appropriate way, about the fact she was conceived with a donor egg. I have read various recommendations around it, and now I'm much more confused than when I started. My husband is inclined to leave well enough unknown. However, I feel if it came out later in life, it would be really confusing or possibly hurtful for her. Obviously, I don't want her to reject me. However, I do think it's best for her own future that she knows. Can you share any light on all the confusion?
This is an area I actually do some work in. So, So, you know, I've had lots of conversations like this one. First of all, she's 5. So when your husband says leave well enough alone, does he mean indefinitely or
yes.
because she's 5? And when you say if it comes out later in life, it would be really confusing and hurtful. That's true if it's much later in life. But if we're talking about at 5, she's not asking any questions about where do babies come from?
Yeah.
Tell me how I was made. If you're not getting any questions, I tend to let children initiate a lot of the conversation. When they ask you a question, they're ready for an answer, and the answer should be true, honest, and developmentally appropriate.
Mm.
Okay. So if she has been, and she's coming up to an age, if she hasn't, she will. So if you're not having the conversation right now, you will be having it in the next year or two. You won't get beyond 7 without that question coming up, typically. Okay.
Mm.
There's a couple of ways to approach it. What I'd say to you is the National Infertility Support and Information Group, I think I've got that right, NISIG.com, is a website that has a lot of information up there in this kind of general area. It won't all be applicable to this family, but some of it will. But the reason I mentioned them specifically is a couple of years ago, they did a project with the children's book author Sive Devlin and children's book author and illustrator Tarsila Cruz. And they produced these books called A Special Gift. And there's different books for A Special Gift if you're a single parent by choice. So you maybe had donor conception in that regard, or if you had a sperm donor, an egg donor, there's different variations of the story. So there is a beautiful
story. Yeah.
And you can, you know, connect with that book through that website, NISIG.com. And I think that can be very helpful. And even if you read it first, and we should always read those books first as adults, by the way, don't just crack it open and read it to your child. you might say, it's not quite the way we want to go, fine, but you might find a framework that will help you structure the conversation you do want to have.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a little bit of a guideline, but obviously as parents, this is entirely your own to script. I generally talk to kids, no matter how they came into the world, that there are three things needed to make a baby. And in this case, you'll be saying, you know, you need an egg, you need sperm, you need a special room in the body to grow the baby in. And you had two of the three things and you needed help with the third thing. Mm. And a kind person called a donor, because a donation is when somebody gives you something to help you. A donor gave the third part. And that third part was the egg, and that's a cluster of cells. You can get as technical or not as you like with that. And that is how we made you, and you grew inside my body, and then you were born whatever way you want to go with that bit. Mm. So you're not saying there is another parent out there either.
No,
you know, because
yeah.
You know, that's not a story you have. This is an anonymous donor. So you don't have that narrative to open up or bring. So that's the truth. It's very honest, and you're keeping it calm and factual. Don't let the first time you say any of this be to your child, though. It should always be that you've practiced it. You're supremely fluent and competent and confident in what you're going to say. It's very likely a young child go, oh, OK.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's it. And then the questions might come later, and you will grow and extend the detail of that story as they grow, because then they may have more questions about, did the donor help anyone else out? Are there any other people I might be genetically connected to? That'll come much, much later. If it does come, if you have that information, and it is okay to say, I don't actually know that, but I can do some research and I can look up and see if I can find out. As parents always say, when you need to pause something or slow it down, what a great question.
Yeah.
I don't think I have the answer, but I'll definitely find it out, because it gives you time.
Yes. Yeah. Because I imagine this is analogous to being adopted, and
not
generally speaking, adoptive parents definitely do tell the child at some point.
Yeah, and that child has a right to know their birth story. You know, they really do. But I think, you know, if you're going to be introducing it and it hasn't been a question yet in your home, the other thing, Sean, with this is to be attuned to the fact that when you tell a young child a story, you cannot control who else they go and tell.
Yeah. Yeah.
My news today teacher is, you know, so, you know, you can always say that's our private family information. That's our private family story. We don't tell other people about that. But, you know, you've limited control once you do tell your child. So, you know, if that's something you want to be very conscious about, be aware of when and how you tell your child that they are of an age where you can reason with them around that, which is not 5 years old.
Yeah. What's your news? Mammy was drinking wine. I'm adopted, and I was told at such a young age that I don't even remember being told, says one listener. I would think this is the best way to go about things. Joe says, both my kids are donor conceived. My advice is to tell them early. It's a much smaller part of their life than you'd think. And they live with it very easily. The children's books Joanna talks about are a great way of introducing it.
Yeah, so, they're super.
We have a 5 year old. Oh, no, this is making Joanna angry time. I think this one. We have a 5 year old and a 2 year old. They're great girls, but like any kids, can have their naughty moments. Our go to method of discipline is the step, where we send them to sit on the bottom of the stairs for a few minutes to think about what they've just done, usually for things like smacking the other one in the head, etc. But we are increasingly finding the step ineffectual. The older one almost likes going there now. She's completely pulled the rug from under us. What is a good alternative punishment?
Anything else. Mm. Anything else than this. This is not an effective punishment. The idea of punishment, first of all, like discipline should always aim to teach behavior that you want to see. Mm. Rather than punishing behavior you don't want to see.
Yeah.
There's no learning here. A 5 year old and a 2 year old who sit on a step to think about what they've done so that they can reflect and then make repair, you're deluding yourself. That's not happening. No 5 and 2 year old are doing that. None of them. No matter how smart you say they are, they're not doing that because they don't have capacity to do that. We wouldn't expect a child. That calls for a level of self-regulation. Like, you know, this is such a soapbox for me. I'm not into the naughty step, however you'd like to brand it, thinking step, timeout step, whatever you want to call it. I'm not into it at all because you are isolating a child in a state of dysregulation, they're worked up, they're revved up, and you're saying, you sort that out and then you can come back and be with the rest of us.
Yeah.
It's not okay. Because you're setting them up to fail. Now, a lot of them will know the way off this step is to say that magic word, sorry, but do they mean it? Absolutely not.
Yes.
Are they going to hit their sibling on the head tomorrow? 100% yes. There's no learning in this. You have a 5-year-old and a 2-year-old. So you've got very little impulse control, very poor sense of delayed gratification. Frustration thresholds are really fragile. When the 2-year-old or 5-year-old annoy each other, hitting is a very effective way to say, hey, I'm not happy about what you're doing right now because I don't have the emotional fluency to do it any other way. So I think what you're doing is a futile exercise, and the pulling the rug. I mean, there's a part of me that loves a child though, and I love this step. I'm going to sit here all day. Under the age of 7 or 8, you're not going to get any joy with that. You're looking at distraction and redirection. So don't hear what I'm saying as permissive parenting either. You absolutely say no. We do not hit in this family. I know you're cross that your sister took your whatever. We do not hit. So you start with the limit, then you acknowledge the feeling, you return to the limit, and then you're saying, the next time that happens, you come get one of us and we will help you work this out. The next time that happens, you walk away and you get help with it. And you repeat that over and over because young children learn through repetition. And then you sort of stay with them for a minute or two to get them set up in some other new little activity so that you can step away because you have redirected them to something positive to do. Time in, not for your 2-year-old, but time in is another way to think about the time out and sort of invert the process. With a time in, Sean, you separate the child from, I'm going to say, the field of action, okay,
yes.
Whatever is going on.
Field, yeah.
And you stay with them and you separate them from what's happening, but they're with you. You maybe do something like look out a window together, talk about what you see. Do you hear that dog barking? I wonder what kind of dog it is. You're just gently using the sort of musicality of your voice, your touch, you're right with them, you're giving a little shoulder rub or holding them in your arms, and you are co-regulating them down. And then you bring them back in and you go to that redirection and distraction I talked about with them. Also give do-overs, especially for the 5-year-old. Oh, I think you forgot how we treat each other in this family. Do you want to try that again? If your sister takes your toy, do you remember what you're supposed to? Let's try it again. Do over. If they get it right the second time, praise that, forget what happened and move on.
Yeah.
Those are the things that will be effective at 5 and 2, but they won't do better because, you know, children are not, I don't love describing children as naughty or bold. They're not, they're learning. They're learning all the time. And the best way to learn is to get it wrong, you know, make mistakes.
Yeah.
And children are not trying to be difficult, but they're often trying to communicate they're having a difficulty. I'm tired, I'm hungry, I'm frustrated, I'm fed up. They can't do anything with language to express that to us other than with behaviour. I think you've got two great little communicators here. It's just how you're hearing it.
I'm impressed that the 2-year-old even stays on the naughty step. How does that work?
I'd say that. I mean, what is it they say? Put them there for 2 minutes. Anyway, it doesn't work. Yeah, absolutely doesn't work.
Because 2-year-old will be at the top of the stairs. I'm really struggling with my child's phone use. He's 14 and constantly on it, even during family meals or when we're trying to have important conversations. For example, last night at dinner, my child was texting the whole time, even though we were discussing something important about their schoolwork. I've tried setting limits, but they just don't seem to care, and it's starting to cause tension at home. How can I address this without making things worse or getting into a big argument?
Oh, now there's a couple of things in here. First of all, you might be a conflict-averse parent. How can I address this without making things worse? Parenting a teenager means having creative, even playful ways to engage in conflict because it is part of their adolescent development. You know, some teenagers do conflict loud and proud. You know, they'll shout and swear and roar at you. And some of it's more passive. You know, that art of delay we talked about before where it's like, yeah, I'll get to it. I'll do it in a minute. Oh, yeah, I'll do that later. And they've no intention of doing it. And you'll be the one who flips the lid while they look seemingly calm. But it's very effective conflict for them. But if you're saying, I just don't want that, I don't want to have conflict, then actually what's happening here is you have a 14-year-old who is calling the shots. And I mean, no, like you say, you know, I've tried setting limits. He doesn't seem to care. No teenager says, oh, high five. Thanks a million for the limits. Yeah, love those. Yeah. None of them are going to do that. And they will kind of eye roll and say, you're being ridiculous. Everyone does this. That's how they get around it. But he's 14. He does not get to set the rules in your home around phone use or anything else. You do as the parent. Boundaries, clear limit setting. Now, clear limit setting is calm. It's consistent, and you have to use kind of logical consequences. So if you're saying there is going to be no phones, and we should all be saying there should be no phones at the table when you're eating.
As a bare minimum.
Any of us, adults included though. So nobody should have a device at the table. And, you know, there should be phone, ban the phones, but actually just practicing phone-free zones is a really effective way when they already have phones, you know, when the horse is bolted. But putting a boundary around it that there is no phones in bedrooms, there is no phones around the meal table. And on a Sunday, I'm being arbitrary now, but on a Sunday afternoon, we have phone-free time as a family and we do something together. Okay, boundary. You're not saying you can't have your phone at all, but you're saying this is the boundary and you've got to hold that gently yet firmly in place. But I'd be doing it, Sean, with this situation sooner rather than later because he's 14 and you've got to get control back on this. And being in control means never having to say, I'm in charge, I'm in control, because you just do it rather than say it. So, you know, this was a conversation about homework, and what you're describing here isn't just a child choosing their phone. It's a child who's really showing you disrespect and is very clearly communicating, I don't want to talk to you about homework. I don't want to have this conversation. And I believe, because again, developmentally for teenagers, they've left that age, or at least they understand they've left that age of do as you're told, command, and they've entered that age of consent, you know. Compliance is now up to me. I don't have to do what you say. So I do think as a parent, I think what you're describing here is a fairly classic 14-year-old, one who's not got a lot of consistent boundaries and limits and is making the most out of that. As a parent, you might benefit from some support around helping you to put more structure and boundaries in place. Like if as a parent you're listening saying, that's exactly what I have a hard time with, maybe consult with somebody, you know, like a mental health professional. Anyone who works with in mental health with teenagers also works with their parents and will do what we might call psychoeducation with parents, where you can say, OK, let's do a little bit of therapeutic parenting around this. What small changes here could make a big difference? How can you affect change in your child's behaviour by changing how you're engaging with this and responding? I actually think that could be helpful here to tease out why the setting and holding of limits is so difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
But now is the time to get on top of this, because at 14, you can turn it around. You can go and say, look, I've messed up. I didn't put clear rules down about the phone, but I'm going to right now. Here's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
A phone is not a right. It's a privilege. And so you have to be able to say, look, if you can't engage with your phone appropriately, then there are going to be other consequences. And I'm not going to get into what the consequences are, because that's up to individual situations. But it is about your child learning that you are in charge, you know, that you're going to stop them in the situation getting out of control. They'll never thank you for those limits, but it promotes safety and security and reassurance. And our kids need it, especially at this, what's still the early stage of adolescence, 13 to 15 years old. This is when we need hands-on parenting.
Yeah.
As much as when they're little, arguably, they need hands-on parenting right now.
And I can't see a way around this where perhaps there won't be a row or door slamming or a huff or something.
I mean,
I
don't expect your 14-year-old to go, what a great idea.
Yeah.
You know, I expect them to test and seek to defy limits, but that is their developmental job. It is ours to hold those limits gently yet firmly in place. You know, structure is about bending without breaking. So you can negotiate and be flexible to some degree, but you are clearly communicating the limit here. No, it's the last line that kind of really concerns me, is that you want to do this without having an argument. I think that's the problem. You will have an argument. It's how you engage with that conflict with your child.
Also, as well, it just strikes me more and more, especially for people that age and their brains aren't fully formed yet. They're holding this addictive, literally an addictive device in their hands and they're staring into it 20 hours a day.
And even as adults, we know how it can nurture really compulsive behaviour in us. Anyone who's ever turned your, and do it if you haven't, like put your, let's say your social media apps on a timer so they tune out after half an hour and then count how many times do you mindlessly pick up your phone to check.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'll see the compulsive behaviour that this promotes. You're like, I don't even know why I was checking that, but I just did it. Mm. You know, so I don't expect a teenager to self-regulate their phone use at all. But as parents, it's easy to kind of blame parents. And I don't think that's helpful either.
Yeah.
I think as parents, we need collectively, we need support and help and advice and structure around how best can we manage this.
Yeah, God help us all. A couple of comments about the naughty step or the bold step. One person says, I completely disagree. Mm-hmm. My 4-year-old knows after the first warning she will go in the bold step for 4 minutes and not to leave until we talk to her and take her off the step. And she won't be bold again after that. Yes, there are days when she might go in it 2 or 3 times. But over the last year, she's rarely on it. The odd day with where she is really bold, we confiscate some toys for a few days.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, we won't agree on that.
Yeah. And but somebody else wonders, what are parents supposed to do for a naughty step if they live in a bungalow? That's the problem there. Listen to Joanna Fortune more.
Don't
That's
do
what
it.
I would suggest you do. Joanna, thanks a million as ever.
Moncrief. Weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.